Morning. I'm Scott Robinson. I'm here on behalf of Stacey Denman Harris. As the court knows, I briefed the case in chronological order. If permitted to do so, however, I would like to start and focus on issue number four, because I believe there is a pernicious eroding of a long-standing rule of law in Colorado as it relates to accomplice testimony instructions. As the court knows from my brief, the accomplice instruction dates its roots back to when Colorado was a territory in 1873, in the case of People versus Solander. And there's a long, uninterrupted line of cases from then, holding not just that a defendant is entitled to an accomplice credibility instruction, but that that instruction would appropriately tell the jury, the ultimate determiners of fact, what corroborating evidence is. In 1975, as this court surely knows, the Supreme Court of Martinez, dealing with a very difficult case, a drive-by shooting in the days before they were called drive-by shootings, decided that because there was essentially clear-cut and overwhelming corroboration of the accomplices in that case, and there were several, there were two accomplices who testified, that the instruction, the stock instruction, need not be given. But I think Martinez has to be read in the context of the facts. There really was overwhelming corroboration. And if there's one thing that we did not have in the case of People versus Harris, again, although I did not try the case, I'm certainly as familiar as I can be from a cold record, the one thing we know is that the corroboration was less than overwhelming. There were...
Pardon me for interrupting. But there is some corroboration, is there?
Oh, there's absolutely what a jury could determine to be corroboration. And that's the key point. If you look at those earlier cases, focus, for example, on the 1940 decision of the Supreme Court in Schechtel. It's clear that the jury ultimately determines what is adequate corroboration. The only time a court can do that as a matter of law is when the corroboration is clear-cut and overwhelming. And that's the theme that I draw from the case law, Martinez notwithstanding, because in Martinez there was really overwhelming corroboration. And
but that wasn't the rule that the Supreme Court set forth, was it?
That's not what the Supreme Court explicitly said. But I don't think you can read a single case, even a Supreme Court case, out of context when you have a long line, a century's worth of case law, saying that this instruction, which says to the jury, this is how you consider this particular type of witness, I don't think that the intent of the court was to wash out all of that. We all know the expression, hard cases made bad law, and I'm not directly saying that that's what happened in Martinez. But in reality, what they said was, in the posture of this case, we cannot say that this is reversible error. I don't think that's true here.
Counsel,
sure.
The defendant wanted an instruction that, you know, effectively told the jury, you know, there is no evidence other than the testimony of these of the witnesses which attempts to establish the participation of the defendant in the crimes. But that instruction would be erroneous given the evidence in the case. What about the documentation of the wire transfers? Wouldn't that documentation corroborate the prosecution's case? And wouldn't that make the requested instruction, in fact, factually incorrect, not just legally incorrect?
We know for a fact that the instruction that was tendered was imperfect at best and erroneous at worst. There's no doubt about that. But as I have cited numerous cases in my brief, it's the responsibility of the trial court to work with defense counsel to craft an appropriate instruction as long as the area that the instruction is appropriate. And my position is that the area, the subject matter of the instruction is fully justified. We have the wire transfers. Again, this could be an innocent fact. And we have the testimony of an officer that he recognized Harris's voice and he testified about what he heard Harris say on recordings. That's it. That's all the corroboration. So if you look back at Schechtel in 1940, what the court says is that you're entitled to an instruction. an instruction that tells the jury what corroborating evidence is, because it's the jury that ultimately decides if there's adequate corroborating evidence. And in that instruction, to which the defendant is entitled, if the prosecution's case is based to a large extent, that's a quote from Schechtel, on accomplice testimony. And I don't see how anybody can read this record and not conclude that the testimony of Lactone and Houston was in fact the bulk, the majority of the prosecution's case. It was not all of it. There's no doubt that a jury could determine that there was corroboration, but they were never given the additional tool of the accomplice instruction to guide them in their assessment of the testimony of these two women. And that's why I'm emphasizing this issue over all others in my brief, because I believe that it is a bit of a misstatement that a court could then say, well, there's some corroboration, so you don't get any instruction. Look back at these instructions that were have been authorized by the court, approved for almost a century. Those instructions all tell the jury what corroboration is. If there was no corroboration, then there's no need to tell the jury that. So my position is that Mr. Harris did not receive a fair trial because the jury was not adequately instructed regarding the two, by far, most important witnesses who testified.
Pardon me for interrupting again.
Please, I refine it. I didn't come here prepared to give a speech.
I understand. I understand this isn't a forensics competition. I have two concerns about what you said, and so help me, please, address those concerns. The first is that as I understand the officer's testimony who testified about, and at this point, because the jury's convicted, we have to assume that the officer overheard Mr. Harris on the phone talking to his girlfriend in the jail, and that he, in the course of that, he said some pretty incriminating things. Would you agree with that?
Yes, although it was not, the jury never heard the actual recording.
I understand.
And that's troublesome to me, because then what you have is the officer's account of what he says was on a recording that was not made available to the jury. But that is absolutely a fair assessment of what the officer said. It included an admission by Harris, if in fact it was Harris, that he was with Selena. There's no doubt about that. I mean, the record is clear that there was some corroboration if the finder of fact determined that it was adequate to support the testimony of the two accomplices.
And here's my second concern, which circles back to the question of Martinez. The Supreme Court is free, even after 100 years of precedent, to chart a new course if it wishes to do so. That's what our Supreme Court gets to do. That's part of their prerogative. And if that is what they have done with Martinez, I understand your appeal to history, and I understand that there is force behind it. But if the Supreme Court has set forth a new rule, that's what we have to follow, isn't it?
Well, I agree that this court is bound to follow cases of the Supreme Court. My position is that Martinez is an anomaly that's distinguishable on its facts, and it would be different if, in fact, the court, and I believe it was Justice Day, in Martinez, went through the case law from Solander through Schechtel and decided to overrule those cases. That didn't happen. It was, in effect, in my belief, a determination that in this particular case, because the corroboration was so critical, so overwhelming, that it would be unnecessary and improper to give the accomplice instruction to the jury. And so I'm not asking this court to ignore Martinez, but I'm asking the court to put Martinez into context.
And if Martinez read just like you spoke, I think that, you know, I would be more convinced, but it doesn't read just like you speak.
Well, that's true.
It basically says this is unnecessary. And so I'm really wondering whether, you know, whether this really is, our Supreme Court has said, we've decided to make a change here. And because the language of that seems pretty clear to me. Am I wrong?
I wouldn't say you were wrong. Your interpretation of Martinez certainly differs from mine. And yes, I'm speaking as an advocate, but I'm also speaking as an advocate who is evaluating the case law that preceded Martinez. And the fact is that there was no discussion in Martinez rejecting the rule in Schechtel, rejecting the rule from Solander, rejecting the rule in Davis. I mean, it's not that there's one or two isolated cases about accomplice testimony. In Martinez, what the court determined is limited to the facts of a case in which the evidence is overwhelming. That's the position I take on behalf of Mr. Harris, and I think it's a position that has the support of historical background and the absence of any discussion by the court of anything to the contrary. Now, if I could just grab a couple of minutes to talk about the sentencing issue. I know, I'm doing this in reverse. I'm doing the last issues.
You may use your time as you wish, Mr. Roberts.
You know, the way I look at the sentencing issue, it's really clear-cut. If a judge imposes a sentence in open court and says nothing about whether a sentence runs consecutive or concurrent, and the defendant goes out that side door to join his other inmates in the county jail, the trial court loses jurisdiction to increase the sentence by making it consecutive. That is my position. In this case, we have the additional fact, which quite frankly should not be dispositive. At some point you feel like you're dancing on the head of a pin, but the additional fact that a transport order was entered prior to the issuance of the minutes. That fact may not be necessary because the case law seems pretty clear that once that sentence is imposed, if the judge never says the magic words consecutive or consecutively, the judge loses jurisdiction to change the sentence later. It's not a question of intent. It's a question of jurisdiction.
I understand. We have an opinion from this court that says that a situation like that, although it involved a not counts in the same case but another case, creates a presumption of concurrent sentence, right?
Right, that's Sandoval case.
Right, you cited that.
If you couple Sandoval with, I think it's Righi, R-I-G-H-I, you couple those two together, put Duran into the mix, and what you have is a fairly straightforward rule.
So if we have a presumption of concurrent sentences in this case, then what is there anything that could overcome the presumption of concurrent sentences? For example, hypothetically, I know this is not the case here, but hypothetically, what if the court directly asked counsel, does your client have any other felony convictions? And counsel, who is either ignorant of the fact or is being cute, and again, this is not the case here, says, no, Your Honor. And so the court says, okay, concurrent. And the court later discovers that the defendant had prior felony convictions. Would that entitle the court to bring him back and say, well, we've had a problem here. I made a specific request. I received an inaccurate answer that affected my sentencing decision, so I can bring the defendant back and resentence that person.
My position would be that the court cannot. You could certainly discipline the lawyer, and strongly so, but jurisdiction is jurisdiction. And I think once, if the court is willing to impose a sentence based on a statement of counsel, something that the court should have had the ability to rely on, then unfortunately, I think the sentence stands. But that's not the case here.
I know.
The only magic word that was ever uttered during the sentencing regarding concurrent versus consecutive was the word concurrently.
On the theft counts.
Right. But by inference, if that's all you have, I think at that point it's not just a presumption. Once the defendant leaves the courtroom, the court cannot enhance the sentence in the minimis. Any other questions? I see I have a grand total of a minute, which I will reserve if possible.
Of course.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. It is the court. Catherine Hanscom, registration number 25464, appearing on behalf of the people in this matter. Addressing the accomplice credibility instruction, I'd like to talk about Martinez because I think it directly refutes the defendant's claim that it's for the jury to determine whether there's corroboration. I think all of the case law, including recent case law from this court in Petchow and in Montoya, it makes it very clear that the instruction should only be given if there is uncorroborated testimony of an accomplice. And so the question is, was there corroboration? The courts talk about the different types of corroboration, all of which we have here. We have corroboration from the other accomplice. We have corroboration, substantial corroboration from the defendant's own statements and from the wire transfers. And so based on that, the court properly rejected the instruction. It seems that the defendant's primary argument is that, well, wait a minute, this is for the jury to decide. And in Martinez, the court specifically addressed that issue and quoted language with approval from Wilkins versus People, which is a 1922 case, but the court quoted it with approval. And they talked about, it is urged to us that it's for the jury to decide. However, it's true that it's up for them to determine whether it's sufficient, the question of whether the instruction should be given in the first place is for the court, because it would be misleading to suggest that this case was based on the uncorroborated testimony of an accomplice when it simply was not. And so that's exactly the rationale that the trial court gave in this case for determining that the instruction should be given.
Ms. Hansen, would you please be so kind as to address Mr. Robinson's statement that Martinez is simply an application of a longstanding principle, and that we should not rely on that in the way you want us to rely on that, because Martinez was a case of overwhelming facts.
Well, I certainly don't think that Martinez stands for the proposition that when you don't give the instruction only when there's overwhelming facts. I think what the proposition is the same throughout all the case law. When there's uncorroborated testimony of an accomplice, then you give the instruction. If there's corroboration, you don't. Martinez was a case where there was perhaps more corroboration, but the question is not whether there's overwhelming corroboration, it's whether there is any. And in Petchow recently, or not so recently, but one of the more recent cases, they simply applied that well-established principle that I think was the principle from the get-go. I don't think Martinez changed the law. I think it just applied the law. But it acknowledged the claim that was made that it's for the jury determination, which is also a claim being made here. So it adds that some of the other cases don't. But it's just a general principle, and it's just been applied in all these cases over the years. We don't take issue with the principle. We just simply think, as the trial court did, that there was evidence of corroboration. That's okay.
When you say corroboration, and it can be any corroboration, does it have to go to the substance of the charges, the corroboration, or if the accomplice testifies that it was a bright sunny day and there's something that corroborates that, that's sufficient?
What the evidence has to corroborate is the defendant's involvement in the crime, and that's talked about in Montoya and the other cases. However, the corroboration, so if there was simply some corroboration, perhaps that it was on a Tuesday, if that was the only corroboration, that might not be sufficient. There has to be corroboration of the defendant's involvement. However, the corroboration itself doesn't need to corroborate every part of the accomplice's testimony. It can be small parts, it can be large parts, and it can come from different sources. Like I said, it can come from the defendant's own statements, which we have here. It can come from the fact that the accomplices corroborated each other. It can come from third-party evidence, such as the jail phone call that they heard it, and the fact that a lot of the comments that the were overheard in the jail phone call were testified to by Ms. Lactone at trial as well. So we have quite a bit of cross-corroboration going on here, all of which indicated the defendant's involvement. So that's the key thing. It has to show the defendant's involvement, but it doesn't have to corroborate in every aspect. Does that answer your question?
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any further questions about this issue or any of the other issues. I'd briefly like to talk about the sentencing issue since Mr. Robinson brought that up. I think what you have here is a situation where the Colorado case law addresses situations where you either have silence as to concurrent or consecutive at the sentencing, the oral pronouncement, and silence in the written minimus, which is Sandoval. And there they created a presumption of concurrence. You have a situation where you have an oral statement of concurrence in the, and then in the written statement, it's consecutive, so you have a conflict. And in that case, the courts apply a presumption of concurrence. But the, this court hasn't addressed, and the Supreme Court hasn't addressed, what you have when you have, at the most here, I mean, obviously I've argued in the brief that I think the court, the way the court structured the sentences indicates an intent in the oral pronouncement to make them concurrent. But to the extent that this court disagrees and finds that it's ambiguous, I think at most it's ambiguous, there you have a situation such as they described in Villano. It's not the situation they had in Villano in the Tenth Circuit, but they described how where you have ambiguity in the oral pronouncement and no ambiguity in the written judgment of sentence and conviction, which is what we have here, you use the written judgment as evidence of the court's intent.
So is it your position then that the written minimus would be what overcomes the presumption of concurrent sentencing, you know, given the ambiguity of the oral pronouncement?
Well, I think first you don't have a presumption in this case because you don't have a situation where you have where the presumption has arisen. You don't have the silence on both that would create the presumption. You don't have the conflict between the two which would create the presumption. So you simply don't have a presumption. What you have here at most is an ambiguity in what the oral pronouncement was, and the Tenth Circuit has said we look to the written minimus to determine the court's intent. So on the outset, I don't think you need to rebut any presumption, but to the extent that there is somehow a presumption created because of the ambiguity, it's certainly rebutted by the court's written clear directions. And because we don't have the conflict here, there's no need to rely on any sort of presumption and assume any sort of concurrency.
Pardon me, Ms. Hansen, but I'd like to test that a little bit. As I read the sentencing transcript, the trial court said, okay, on the coke account, I'm going to impose a sentence. This is what it is. It then proceeded to discuss the theft counts, and it said, I'm going to impose a sentence on the theft counts, and I'm going to make that concurrent. Am I right so far?
Not exactly. What the court said was, with regard to the theft counts, I'm going to run those, make those running concurrently.
I understand. It discussed the theft counts and then says, I'm going to make those run concurrently.
Correct.
There is no reference in the discussion of the theft counts to the coke account.
Correct.
So at this point, I understand it's your argument that that creates an ambiguity, but how do you respond to what Mr. Robinson might say, which is, well, look, the court had every opportunity to say that it wanted to run those counts consecutive to or concurrent to the coke account. It chose not to do so. Isn't that a clear statement that it did not intend those to run consecutively?
No, I don't believe so. I mean, basically, if anything, I think it's the opposite. The fact that the court made it clear that he wanted the theft counts to run concurrently and clearly treated the coca as kind of a separate chunk of the sentence and the theft counts as a separate chunk, said those run concurrently, I think more likely the intent was to make them separate sentences, additional sentences, particularly in light of the fact that the well-established intent of the COCA statute is to create enhanced penalties and additional punishment beyond just committing these predicate acts.
But again, we're in a situation where the court, this was not a mandatory consecutive sentence. The court had discretion to make this sentence concurrent or consecutive. And clearly the court had to establish a sentence for the COCA count, and it did so. And then the theft counts, which are more alike than the theft counts and the coke account, and so it makes a decision on the theft counts, and so the next logical step is to say, all right, these are concurrent to or consecutive to, but it didn't take that step.
Correct.
Your argument is that is ambiguous, but isn't that equally consistent with the interpretation that it's a clear statement that I'm done?
No, I respectfully disagree. I think the fact, if anything, that it didn't specify whether it was the theft chunk was supposed to be concurrent with the other, if anything, creates an ambiguity, because you could have two separate inferences. You can easily have two separate inferences in this situation. And where you have these two separate inferences, we've seen in other areas of the law, that creates an ambiguity. And so, like I said, to the extent that you don't agree that the way the court structured his comments shows an intent to do consecutive, I respectfully disagree that it shows a clear intent to make them concurrent. And in light of the fact that at most you can read two interpretations into this, that creates an ambiguity.
Fair enough.
Which then triggers the need to look at the extrinsic evidence.
Fair enough. Let me take that one next step.
Okay.
Assuming that that's now the case, do we have any Colorado State cases that discuss the ambiguity in this context?
Not that I found.
So you would be relying on those federal cases?
Yes.
Okay.
And I think that you know, is consistent with, you know, what we've done in this situation. I mean, they've, even in the cases where there's no ambiguity, where you have in Sandoval the silence, the court has, or in the silent, the conflict, the court has only created a presumption. And so
that goes to my question to Mr. Robinson about, you know, when, if that's our law, if our law is not ambiguity, our law is, in this context, we create a presumption, then what rebuts that presumption?
Well, and we don't have law that in this context creates the presumption, and I would argue that we shouldn't. But if this court were to determine that even in this situation there's a presumption, I certainly think there's nothing that indicates in the case law that it's not rebuttable. And the federal cases make it very clear, and I think the analysis is completely sound, that it's possible to rebut the presumption with clear indication of the court's intent. And we have that here. Unless this court has any further questions, I'd be happy to talk about these issues or any other issues.
No, thank you for being patient with me.
Oh, no problem. Thank you very much, and we would ask that this court affirm. Thank you.
Filing my rule of not bringing paperwork up to the podium, I just want to point out that in Martinez, the court specifically cited Schechtel and Davis multiple times, including for cases outlining appropriate cautionary instructions on testimony of an accomplice, see Davis, Schechtel, and Boucher. So again, my argument is straightforward, that Martinez is restricted to its facts. We have a court that specifically says, in the posture of this case, we cannot say that the judge committed reversible error. And I will point out that the court also expressed some doubt as to whether the other witnesses were even accomplices. While we do not rule that the participants were accomplices as a matter of law, still their testimony was sufficiently corroborated that we do not believe that the defendant was prejudiced by the court's action. Sounds like a harmless error analysis to me. Any further questions?
No.
I've exhausted my time. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Mr. Robinson. Mr. Robinson, Ms. Hansen, thank you very much for your oral arguments today. I'm sure we found them very helpful. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.